Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to this Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy conference call. I'm Irina Fascanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have Dwight Bashir and Elizabeth Cassidy, both Deputy Directors for Policy and Research at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, here with us today to discuss the findings of the Commission's 2015 annual report. Prior to joining USERF, Dr. Bashir worked with the United Nations, the Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy, and other non-governmental organizations focused on human rights and conflict prevention. Dr. Bashir's commentary has been featured on major media channels, including BBC, CNN, Al Jazeera, and in publications including The Washington Post, Foreign Policy, and others. Ms. Cassidy manages the Commission's annual report process and covers the United Nations international and comparative constitutional law issues, blasphemy laws, U.S. refugee and asylum policy in Western Europe. Prior to joining USERF, Ms. Cassidy was Assistant Executive Director of UN Watch. She's taught courses at Princeton University, Seton Hall University School of Law, and the University of Namibia. Dwight, Elizabeth, thank you both for being with us today to provide us with an overview of the findings of the Commission's 2015 annual report and to talk about what these findings mean for U.S. efforts to advance freedom of religion globally. Dwight, it would be great if we could start with you to give us your perspective.
Thank you, Irina, and thanks to CFR for providing this opportunity and for all of you who have joined the call. As we discuss some of the major findings and recommendations from the Commission's 2015 annual report. I'll start with a brief summary of the religious freedom landscape over the past year in a number of countries, and then Elizabeth will focus on some of our recommendations that relate to the dire and unprecedented number of displaced persons and refugees worldwide. Afterward, we'll be happy to answer any questions you might have, and we'll be joined during the Q&A by some of our colleagues here at the Commission, who focus on various regions around the world. Without question, freedom of religion is a pivotal human right that includes the right to believe or not believe, change one's faith, and engage in worship. It also encompasses other human rights, including freedoms of expression, association, and assembly. In the end, for religious freedom to be upheld, all of these rights must be respected. I think as we look back at the past year, the obvious question is whether conditions for religious freedom and these related rights have improved, especially in countries we cited last year as perpetrating or tolerating the most serious violations against these liberties. Such nations include those we recommended for designation as countries of particular concern or Tier 1 countries, marking them as the world's worst religious freedom abusers. They also include those we listed as Tier 2 countries, due to violations that, while not rising to the top tier, are still significant and serious. Unfortunately, I'd have to say the answer to the question about whether things are improving or not is a resounding no. Across the world, we see little evidence that religious freedom conditions have improved in any serious or tangible way, despite a handful of exceptions. For example, after visiting Sri Lanka in March, a commission delegation reported that the new government there is making genuine efforts to improve respect for the rights of religious minorities. Nevertheless, when we look at the 16 countries we recommended last year for Tier 1 status, not one of them has significantly improved its record, and in a number of them, from China to Syria, we've seen signs of further deterioration. We were even compelled this year to add a 17th country to our Tier 1 recommendations list, the Central African Republic. To date, the State Department has designated only 9 of these countries of particular concern that we recommend. And we continue to recommend that the State Department make annual designations and expand its list. We hope it will do so this year. Regarding our Tier 2 countries, of which we've identified 10, as you'll see in our report, religious freedom conditions also remain troubling. Russia continues, for example, its failure to respect religious minorities both at home and in its conquered territories, and Malaysia may be sliding toward a Tier 1 designation next year. Now, in the interest of time, rather than describe conditions in every one of these countries, I'd like to focus on two main kinds of violators, state actors and non-state actors who bear responsibility for abuses. State actors refer to governments, of course, and non-state actors refer primarily to violent religious extremist groups and individuals. When it comes to state actors, some, like China and North Korea, are secular tyrannies which suppress religious groups across the board. Others, like Iran and Saudi Arabia, enthrone a single religion or religious interpretation while persecuting majority Muslims who dissent or embrace alternative views, and both Muslim and non-Muslim religious minorities who have inferior or no status at all in society. These state actors, both secular and religious, abuse religious freedom in many ways, including imprisonment of people due to their religious beliefs, actions, or advocacy. Now, we identify scores of religious prisoners of conscience in the various annual report chapters, as well as through our Defending Freedoms project. For example, in Iran, hundreds of people from Baha'is to Christians, Sufi and Sunni Muslims to majority Shiite reformers and clerics languish in prison for reasons relating directly to their religious beliefs. And unfortunately, electoral democracies are not immune from incarcerating people for religious reasons. The worst example here, I would say, is Pakistan, which joins Iran and Saudi Arabia in punishing people for blasphemy. In Pakistan, more people are on death row or serving life sentences for blasphemy than anywhere else in the world. Pakistan's blasphemy laws not only violate freedom of religion and expression, but they embolden non-state actors, violent extremists, to assault and murder perceived transgressors. Over the past several years, members of religious minorities in Pakistan, from Shiites to Christians, Hindus to Hamadis, have been increasingly victimized by these attackers. For these reasons, we once again urge the State Department to designate Pakistan a country of particular concern. And in some countries of the Middle East, we've observed over the past year an uptick in the targeting of atheists and non-believers. For example, in Egypt, new anti-atheist government initiatives and blasphemy cases increased. And a new 2014 terrorism law in Saudi Arabia makes advocating atheism a crime. Non-state actors also have played a huge role in fueling some of the worst humanitarian crises of our time. Among these, of course, actors is the so-called Islamic State, also known as ISIL or Daesh. From Yazidis to Christians, Shiites to dissenting Sunnis, no religious group has been free of ISIL's barbarism and depredations in its areas of conquest. In both Iraq and Syria, state actors actually sowed the seeds for this problem. In Iraq, the government's marginalization of the country's Sunni minority helped create a climate conducive to ISIL's empowerment. And in Syria, President Assad treated his people for years as members of different sectarian groups vying for his personal favor and protection, rather than as individual citizens possessing equal rights under the law. Under ISIL's reign of terror, women and girls have been kidnapped and enslaved, men and boys beheaded or crucified, families driven from their homes facing starvation and death, and 2,000-year-old communities of life and faith uprooted and threatened with extinction. Because of these abuses, we recommended for the first time this year that the U.S. government call on the U.N. Security Council to refer ISIL to the International Criminal Court for prosecution. Beyond Iraq and Syria, non-state actors have been wreaking similar havoc elsewhere. From mass killings at churches to mass kidnappings of schoolchildren, Boko Haram has cut a wide path of terror across vast areas of Nigeria. In Burma, which a USURF delegation visited last August, Rohingya Muslims have suffered assaults from Buddhist extremists. And in Central African Republic, fighting between Christians and Muslims has destroyed nearly every mosque in the country. Consequently, USURF has recommended for the first time that CAR be designated as CPC. Now, as a result of these conflicts, literally millions of people have been forced to flee for their lives. For humanitarian reasons alone, the world cannot be silent anymore in the face of religious freedom violations, no matter who commits them, whether state or non-state actors. But there's a second reason for concern. As all of you know, in January, extremism struck a kosher supermarket in the Charlie Hebdo newspaper in Paris. The supermarket victims were murdered simply because they were Jews, and the newspaper victims were killed because their attackers deemed them blasphemers deserving punishment. The lesson here is clear. Standing for religious freedom is not just a moral imperative, but a practical necessity for any country seeking to protect its security and that of its citizens. More than ever before, we've concluded that religious freedom deserves to be a priority in our country's foreign policy. With that, let me stop here and turn it over to Elizabeth to highlight our findings and recommendations relating to the growing refugee crisis worldwide.
Thank you, Dwight, and let me add my thanks to ARENA and CFR for inviting us to speak on this call and to all of you who are listening for joining. As Dwight mentioned, one of the issues we highlighted in our annual report this year is the humanitarian toll that results from religious persecution and violence. The world is experiencing an unprecedented displacement crisis. As you may have heard, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, recently announced that as of the end of 2014, 59.5 million people were refugees, internally displaced, or seeking asylum. This was the highest number that UNHCR had ever recorded. Among these individuals are many who have been displaced by religious persecution or violence in countries that are on USERF's Tier 1 or Tier 2 lists. For example, in Iraq, nearly 3 million people have been internally displaced just since the beginning of 2014 due to ISIL's offensive. At least 7 million of Syria's pre-Civil War population is displaced within that country, and more than 4 million are refugees in neighboring states. In Nigeria, more than 1.3 million people have fled Boko Haram. In the Central African Republic, sectarian violence has driven a million or more people from their homes. 80% of Kharg Muslims have fled the country. In Burma, at least 100,000 Kachin Christians and 140,000 Rohingya Muslims are internally displaced, with many living in squalid camps. 1 in 10 Rohingya reportedly have fled Burma by boat, desperately seeking and often not finding safe haven in nearby countries. And a record number of refugees are attempting the dangerous Mediterranean crossing to seek asylum in Europe, with large numbers coming from Eritrea, Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Given the conditions and conflicts in their countries of origin, many of today's refugees have little hope of returning home anytime soon. They find themselves in limbo in neighboring countries, living in poor conditions, without legal status, unable to support themselves, and without education for their children. Their presence and numbers strain host communities, creating economic, social, and political problems. Sectarian tensions can spill over into refugee camps and host communities. Many refugees decide to try to move elsewhere, often via risky journeys aided by smugglers. The United States has long led the world in assisting and resettling refugees, a record of which we all should be proud. Yet given the scale of the current crisis, even the U.S.'s efforts are no longer enough. The U.S. and other governments need to ramp up their collective responses in the face of this vast challenge. Specifically, in our report this year, USERF has called on the United States to increase its assistance to help not only refugees but also host communities, and to encourage other countries to do the same. A major focus of this effort needs to be on ensuring decent living conditions, services, and educational employment opportunities to both refugees and local populations in countries that are facing protracted refugee situations. We also have recommended that the United States government raise the annual U.S. refugee resettlement ceiling from 70,000 to at least 100,000. While resettlement to the United States will only be able to help a small percentage of the world's refugees, it is a vital protection for the most vulnerable. In addition, USERF has been concerned by the slow pace and small number of Syrians resettled to the United States as compared to the scale of that crisis. Since 2011, only around 900 Syrian refugees have been resettled in this country. We welcome the State Department's efforts to resettle more Syrians and the increase in admissions in the current fiscal year, and we hope that this trend will continue. The Commission also has urged increased resources for the Department of Homeland Security and other agencies to allow them to process resettlement applications and conduct security background checks in a timely manner. Also, DHS needs to be sure to properly apply the waivers to U.S. immigration laws, terrorism bars, to ensure that individuals who pose no threat to the United States are not erroneously barred from the U.S. refugee program. Finally, in addition to resettling refugees, the United States needs to ensure that we are protecting individuals who reach our country and seek asylum. As you may know, under a process called expedited removal, U.S. immigration officials can quickly send home non-citizens who enter the U.S. without authorization. There are real concerns documented by Yusuf and others about the effect of this process on asylum seekers. For years, Yusuf has been recommending improvements to better protect asylum seekers, but many of those recommendations have not been implemented. The United States needs to get this process right to ensure that people are not being mistakenly returned to harm or even death. In our brief remarks today, Dwight and I have highlighted just some of the countries and issues covered in the Commission's most recent annual report, or addressed in the report itself, which CFR has circulated and which you can read on USERF's website. And for the rest of the time we have on this call, we'd be happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question. Let's open up to the group for questions.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. Okay, so our first question comes from Sheikh Ubid with Muslim Peace Coalition.
Thank you for the excellent work that the Commission is doing and this excellent presentation. I have a question about, this work needs to continue because the violation of religious freedom seems to be increasing rather than decreasing all over the world, and the Commission's work is so important. You receive a lot of problems when it comes to the violation of human rights in India, whereas when the Commission works, does report about other countries, it does not. So is it interfering with your work when some dedicated groups who are supporters of religious extremism in India try to attack you and criticize you here in the U.S.?
I'm sorry, I didn't. The question was about India.
About India and the heat that the Commission gets from the groups that which are supporters of RSS and VHP in India. And every time the Commission talks about the violation of human rights and religious freedom in India, you come under a lot of attack, whereas that does not happen when you issue reports about other countries.
Well, there are certainly some groups that have taken issue with some of our reporting on India, but there are other countries as well and groups that have taken issue with our reporting. I think that kind of comes with the territory when you're reporting on human rights in other countries. I mean, as you may have noticed in the release of the State Department's human rights report, they also talked about the fact that some governments and groups might not be happy with their reporting. But, you know, we stand by our reporting in all of our countries, I think it comes with the territory.
And I would just frankly, add to that I think we wouldn't be doing our job right if we didn't get some of the feedback from either governments or groups, because we look at conditions on the ground from a variety of sources, and we report them based on a lot of information received and vetting. So in some cases, if the facts speak to the facts, I mean, facts are power in a way, and some governments and groups aren't happy with it. But we certainly, look at everything we're reporting to ensure that it's as accurate as possible.
Thank you. And you're doing a great job. Please continue doing it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Paul Devries with the New York Divinity School.
Thank you very much, and appreciate so much this annual report and the comments already made by Dwight Basher and Elizabeth Cassidy. Thank you. I encountered an eyewitness to burning of about, I think it's 69 different churches in Niamey, Niger. People angry, mostly Muslim, I guess, people angry about the Charlie Hebdo cartoons, although the churches didn't have any cartoons, as far as anyone knew. But I went to your book and noticed that Niger is not even, there's not even a section on Niger. So I guess my question is, Could you comment on the violence in Niger? Is anyone keeping up with that? And perhaps comment on the decision of these churches to forgive the attackers.
Sure. Let me just say something quickly, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague Tiffany Lynch, who's here, who's our analyst who covers Africa. First of all, we don't report on every country in the world in our report every year. We report on about 30 countries, and Niger is not one that we've reported on, but I'll let Tiffany comment on anything she may have been following in Niger.
Yes, we have been following Niger, and we did see those attacks that happened, and as you said, the forgiveness afterwards. For the most part, conditions in Niger are fairly good. They don't reach the standards that of a Tier 1 or a Tier 2 country that we report on, which is why they haven't been in our book this year. That doesn't say that we don't follow it, and if conditions continue to deteriorate, that we will not look more closely at it and potentially include in future reports. But one thing I will say about the issue of the church's forgiveness, one thing that we look at throughout all of our countries is whether or not the governments hold people responsible for societal attacks. This is one thing not just the actual attacks that happen, but we will look at the government of Niger and their response to these attacks.
And have you noted one way or another whether the government is holding people accountable?
To date, no, we have not heard of any arrests or any prosecutions going forward. It's one thing they're looking at, and Niger has been looking at that and looking at a whole host of issues going forward as well.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Again, if you would like to ask a question, you can press star 1 at this time. Our next question comes from John Bryson Chang with the Episcopal Church.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to be exposed to this time of learning. Wanted to ask a question. How does the United States measure and then carry out its foreign policy initiatives in countries where state and non-state actors are clearly confirmed as violators and oppressors of religious freedom? And then attached to that, how much does the United States in its foreign policy initiatives pay attention to the U.S. Commission's annual report, which is quite good and very detailed?
Well, with respect to the second question, I mean, we do get feedback from the State Department, and we know they consider our report. We engage with them on it extensively. They follow some of our recommendations and not others. So I think that's an ongoing conversation that we're having with them. And on your first question about sort of the U.S. Sort of integrating these issues, I think it varies from country to country. And Dwight can chime in. I mean, we're advisory, and so we're very focused on the religious freedom and human rights aspects, but U.S. foreign policy overall has a lot of other competing interests that are being weighed, and sometimes the religious freedom aspects and human rights aspects take more priority than others. Our job is to advocate that they take more priority overall, I think, and we see that to different degrees in different countries.
Let me just add, and I think that's an important question, particularly the first question regarding how do they conduct? And obviously, in a bilateral relationship, there are many levels of communication and diplomacy. So, by statute, though, if a country is a country of particular concern, like this right now, 9 countries the State Department has designated, there's a range of things it needs to do, either issue a waiver in the interest of the act, of which 2 countries fall in that category, Saudi Arabia and Uzbekistan. Or it needs to do something else, all the way potentially to economic sanctions, but it could be a private demarche and canceling of an exchange, cultural or otherwise. I mean, there's a whole range in the statute. So plus there's private and public dialogue that's going on that we know of on many levels with various countries regularly. When we visit countries that we travel to, we're engaging ourselves directly with government officials in country and getting information as we learn more about what's going on the ground, in addition to talking to civil society, religious groups, and others. But the State Department issues its own International Religious Freedom Report each year, and through its conduct of diplomacy is raising these issues, and it does even have a section in saying the different kinds of things it does. Now, there's times where we're not as satisfied with the response on a certain country where we feel there should be a more robust response, but I think we also understand, as Elizabeth was saying, there's a range of issues, obviously, that the State Department is looking at, from security to trade, economic concerns, geopolitical concerns, et cetera, where we're looking at it from a more narrow, looking at freedom of religion or belief, based on, in essence, the international human rights standards. And so, there's different ways to approach that. But I do think the fact that we, our value added really is our recommendations, and we're working with the State Department and congressional offices who have an interest that to raise these issues prominently and to keep them on the front of the radar screen and to engage our various officials so that they're aware that there are concerns at any given time.
Thank you very much, Dwight, and Elizabeth, too.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Christina Olney with In Defense of Christians.
Thank you to ARENA and CFR for hosting this call, and to my former colleagues, Dwight, Elizabeth, and Tiffany, for your excellent work. Dwight, as you know, IDC is particularly concerned with protecting and preserving religious freedom and communities in the Middle East. And I was wondering if you could kind of give us a top-line overview of USERF's policy recommendations for Iraq and Syria this year. And Elizabeth, I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on what you see as the prospects for the refugee cap being increased from the 70,000. And also, do you believe that there is a need for, there's a lot of talk, as you know, in Congress right now about the need for special refugee status for the IDPs. So I'm not sure if that's something that's addressed in the report, but if you could touch on that as well, that would be great.
Well, thanks, Christine. It's good to hear from you. I touched on some of the, obviously, serious concerns over the past year, in particular Iraq and Syria, and how ISIL has, basically introduced a whole new dimension to that situation in these two countries. We have made, several different recommendations relating to these two countries, and frankly, as each day, week goes forward, I think since our report came out at the end of April. There's new developments that warrant new looks at things. But one of the things I mentioned is we, for the first time, called for referral by the UN Security Council to the International Criminal Court to investigate ISIL violations in both Iraq and Syria against religious and ethnic minorities, following models used by Sudan and Libya, or encourage the Iraqi government to accept ICC jurisdiction to investigate these violations after June of 2014, once they entered Iraq. It's such an overwhelming situation. I think Elizabeth will touch on some of, the refugee dimensions. But, another aspect is, in looking, encouraging the global coalition, for instance, to counter ISIL in its ongoing discussions and meetings, to work to develop measures to protect and assist the most vulnerable religious minorities, including by increasing immediate humanitarian aid, prioritizing resettlement to third countries of the most vulnerable, and providing long-term support in host countries for those who hope to return to their homes in a post-conflict situation. I don't think there are any silver bullets in the immediate term, unfortunately, but let me turn it to Elizabeth to look at some of the kind of humanitarian aspects, because, frankly, I think that's what we're really most concerned about in the near term.
Thank you, Dwight.
Thanks, Dwight, and hi, Christina. Nice to hear from you. On the resettlement ceiling, we're hopeful. We know there are a number of other groups that are advocating for an increase as well. I think given the scale of the crisis, 70,000 really just isn't enough anymore, the scale of the overall crisis, let alone the crisis in Iraq and Syria. So we're hopeful, but it remains to be seen. The U.S. does resettle more refugees than any other country in the world. So we already take a lot, but really, I think everybody needs to step up on this one, all of the resettlement countries, and actually also looking at new resettlement countries, because of course the problem right now is you've got these situations where, just looking at Syria and Iraq, people just aren't going to be able to go home anytime soon. You're looking at people displaced for long, long periods of time. So, how do we address that? In our report this year, we did support allowing the president to have authority to designate specially defined groups as refugees based on shared characteristics that identify them as targets for persecution. So we'll be interested in seeing what some of these proposals coming up in Congress are.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from David Waldman with United Methodist Church.
Yes, hi. Thanks so much for the briefing and for the report each year. I really appreciate it. I want to get back to one of the questions around foreign policy and particularly ask about the relationship between the report and concerns about religious freedom and countries that have received significant U.S. military aid. As I look at your list of the Tier 1 and Tier 2, there's quite a few countries you already mentioned, Saudi Arabia and Uzbekistan, is getting those waivers. And just, from your sense, are there situations where religious freedom in places like Saudi Arabia, Uzbekistan, Egypt, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, is being downplayed to the priorities given to U.S. military aid, military allies? That to me is a concern. I'm just wondering what you could say about your interactions with the Pentagon as well as the State Department.
Well, that's a very good question. Let me start with just one example because you mentioned one of these countries. Saudi Arabia doesn't get that military aid from the United States like Egypt does, and that's the country I wanted to talk about just because Egypt is a country that does get $1.3 billion of military assistance from the United States. And, that hold was released in May. The certification went through. But I think as you look at, this is something we've looked at over the years. I think what we're looking at now in a kind of post-2011 Egypt where things have been up and down and up and down, if you look at our report on Egypt, for example, in the U.S. policy section, you see that we do acknowledge, on one hand, that President Sisi, who was elected a year ago after the removal of President Morsi in 2013, the reality is he has made, for instance, some of the right comments and statements. But when you look at the situation on the ground, we couldn't help but continue to recommend them as, a country of particular concern or that top tier based on the fact there haven't been the kinds of reform efforts. Now, we have said with regard to the, military aid, we don't get really into that aspect of U.S. policy other than to say we recommended that a portion of our U.S. military assistance should be used to help police on the ground implement an effective plan for dedicated protection for religious minority communities and their places of worship, particularly Coptic Christians, since they number so many million and are by far the largest Christian population in the whole Middle East. And yet we haven't seen there was some interest some years ago, but because of things changing so rapidly and such a difficult security environment. I think what you see is, a policy that's trying to support the counterterrorism, the security arrangement, yet, still saying if you looked at the recent human rights report, for example, on Egypt that came out from the U.S. State Department last week, it was a very hard-hitting report. Yet, I think some would say, hey, the policies don't necessarily reflect what the situation is on the ground. So we're saying, there needs to be some efforts to see real tangible reforms. And we identify a number of those. But regarding some of the specifics on the military aid, we haven't gotten involved in those details. There was a time that USERF recommended some years ago before 2011 that before certifying military aid, and certifying, by the way, had the language specifically on freedom of religion, that we had to certify that there was adequate religious freedom, that before dispersing the aid, that certification should come through or we should reevaluate it. Now, I think we've taken a little bit of a different tack just because so much is in flux, so it's a little bit more, I think, difficult in that regard.
Could I just follow up and ask, is there any difference in terms of foreign military sales? Because when I mentioned Saudi Arabia, they obviously purchased significant things from U.S. companies through the foreign military sales.
Yeah, that's another element. We haven't actually gone into detail that. We focus on conditions and looking at the range of things that we think could improve the situation. We haven't got into the foreign military sales. We did at one point when Saudi Arabia was first designated in 2004. We thought at that time a response would have been to limit some of these sales to things like shackles, things that could be used internally. It was like a small amount compared to maybe $60 million that we kind of put forward, and there was some interest. And then, of course, there was other things that came up, and then there was a set of policies in Saudi Arabia that the government agreed to kind of implement informally, which we still cite in our report, which we think there needs to be much more progress on those. But that's then when, in 2006, the U.S. government put a waiver. So, you don't have to really get into that issue anymore from a State Department perspective. But we do look at these things, and I think there's always a balance between what's the reality of something moving or the potential of getting implemented versus just making a recommendation that's not going to be taken seriously. So we're constantly trying to weigh which is the best to move forward.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Dr. George Gattagonis with Gattagonis Law and Consulting Firm, LLC.
Yes, thank you to both of the moderators for their admirable, thorough, and comprehensive report. Concern is raised to the following reference. 15 nations were designated through your investigation as Tier 1, if I heard you correctly. And further, if I heard you correctly, the State Department found only 9 of them to be in that upper echelon. Is there an abiding reason that may cover the difference of the 6 nations? Are there concerns that the moderators have regarding a laxity of the scrutiny that the 2 moderators themselves have displayed?
Well, it's correct. The State Department designates countries of particular concern fewer countries than we recommend as such, and I think the reasons for that depend on the country. I mean, for some of them, Pakistan is one, and so that's a country that's a strong U.S. ally, and not one thus far that the U.S. government has been willing to designate. Vietnam is one that was designated and was then taken off the State Department's list. And since then, the State Department and USERF have had a sort of difference of opinion about the conditions in Vietnam. We think that they still need TPC status. Some of the others are more are cases where you get into harder questions of interpreting the law. The law, the International Religious Freedom Act, it talks about governments that perpetrate or tolerate egregious violations to meet the TPC standard. When you get into that toleration prong, if that's got to do with the question of where most of the violations or the worst violations tend to be being committed by non-state actors, and then the question is what is the government doing about it? And I think you can have reasonable differences of opinion about whether the government is tolerating or not. Tolerating seems to encompass some
ability to address them. We actually, this year in recommending CAR at CPC, we explain in our report, we took sort of a broader view because the existing CPC standard with toleration, it doesn't really include these situations where there's no government. And so there's no government to address the violations. We've reached the point because we've sort of seen so many of these situations over the year where we've kind of said we'd like to see the law expanded to include situations where it's either a failed or failing state, essentially. And so that's the interpretation that we're giving. So some of it is a matter of different interpretations of the law and what toleration means.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Zul Casamali with Toronto Area Interfaith Council.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to pay my gratitude to the wonderful work you are doing. The reason I'm using my gratitude is that it is so important that you are the voice of the vulnerable ones around the world who can't speak, and you are speaking on behalf of them. So I'm very grateful to you. My question is that some years ago, Farah Pandit had given a report on her visit to 52 Muslim countries, and she had identified that the youths don't have any education, they don't have any identity, they don't have any future. The only thing they have is the grudge about what has happened to their families, and they are just looking time for them to take the revenge. So having said that, these are very extreme statements. This was given in the report about 8-10 years ago. So my question is, what role are we playing, or how much budget are we giving for prevention? Because at the moment I am seeing that we are doing all firefighting everywhere, which is needed, but at the same time, there has to be a component of prevention. So what are we doing, and how can we make sure that is done so we don't have to get into more difficult issues in the future?
That's a great question. I'm not familiar with that report by Farah Pandit that you referenced, but I do think addressing these issues preventatively and especially issues of the education of young people are really important. In some ways, I think your question is sort of more a question for the State Department than for us, because I can't say that I'm aware of everything that the U.S. is doing on these things. But I do know, like, for example, in the refugee context, we are putting in the Syrian and Iraqi refugee context in particular, the U.S. is focusing some of its humanitarian aid on educational efforts and things like that. To ensure that refugee children and displaced children are able to get some form of education, because many of them have been out of school, for some time, and it is a real concern, as you pointed out, growing up in these poor conditions with a sense of grievance is going to create problems of radicalization potentially down the road, and just not really a recipe for peaceful and healthy society. So, for example, I know that in the information that's just come out recently, in the latest tranche of money that the U.S. has put forward on Syrian and Iraqi refugee issues, there's a number of programs related to education to hopefully get these efforts. But I'm sorry, I don't have at my fingertips, sort of all the details on all of the numbers of what the U.S. is doing on that.
I would just jump in very quickly saying, I don't know if that was a report that Farah Pandit did when she was the special representative to Muslim communities, but if it is, the U.S. government has, I think, and this is beyond, frankly, our kind of focus, but I just, to make you aware that you could pursue and look into that, there are offices at the State Department that now deal with countering violent extremism and counter-radicalization messaging. There's offices there.
There's a special representative still to Muslim communities, as well as an envoy to the OIC, Organization of Islamic Countries, as well as a Bureau for Conflict Stabilization and Operation, a fairly new bureau there in the past few years. And then the Human Rights Bureau that includes religious freedom within that context. There's a Human Rights and Democracy Fund. All of these, to some extent, do conflict resolution, mitigation programs, interfaith activity. I mean, there's a variety of things going on. So this is, you know, I think way beyond our portfolio, but there are elements certainly within the U.S. government and beyond even the State Department that do fund these type of prevention and conflict resolution type programs.
And also, I would just add one more thing. That one piece of this that we've focused on a lot at USERF over the years is looking at school textbooks and trying to get countries to remove language in school textbooks that teaches intolerance of other religious groups and other religious communities. So that's something that we've deemed very important over the years.
I do appreciate your kind response.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Nancy Immerman with Boston University.
Good afternoon, and thanks so much for this report, for the work you do. And a lot of the things we've been talking about is not so much do we have the right information, but what do we do with that? And it's very clear that there are some limits and some frustrations around your ability to get the State Department and the White House and the Congress to respond to the concerns that we have. And I wonder to what extent you're able to actually go directly to the public.
That's a good question, and we do go directly to the public. I mean, we write op-eds and pieces that we publish in various newspapers and websites and all sorts of things, and we speak publicly. Our commissioners give speeches. We on the staff level participate in various events. So we do try to do that as much as we can.
Do you have a social media presence?
We do.
Yeah.
Yep. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter.
Good.
I mean, we put out press releases quite frequently. You can, on our website, USCIRF, USCIRF.gov, you can find all our press statements, all our op-eds. We've even held hearings. You know, part of our authority is to hold hearings as well. We've done more of that in the past since with the advent of social media and so on. I think we've used some different platforms in recent years, but we've held hearings and universities, as Elizabeth was saying, other settings, public settings. We've even gone outside of Washington to hold hearings in California and New York and other places where there's various immigrant communities who have interests and so on. So, yes, we regularly take our message out to the public, whether it's the public at large or academia or through media, social media platforms.
Thanks. And their Twitter handle is at USCIRF, USCIRF, if you want to become a follower.
A number of us also have our own personal Twitter accounts, so you can find us online as well.
Perfect. Let's go to the next question or comment.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Mohammed El-Sanasi with the Network for Religious and Traditional Peacemakers.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for hosting this call, and it's great to hear you, Dawit and Elizabeth. I just want to really to take the discussion to, I know that USERF, they encourage and promote initiatives that might really improve the status of religious freedom and around the world. And I think this is something that needs to be recognized, and if there is an event or an initiative or any program that really helped improve the situation, I think that needs to be encouraged. I'm bringing this up because I want to just mention that there is a role for religious leaders, and particularly most of these countries of concern are Muslim countries, and I'm aware of that there are Muslim scholars around the Muslim world, particularly working on religious freedom issues and trying to come up with the standards and protocols to basically help to provide that kind of protection. Just one example, Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayya is working, as we speak, with the government of Morocco to have a conference for Muslim scholars around the world to discuss issues of religious freedom and rights of minorities in the Muslim majority community, and to come up really with clear standards and protocols that really could help to improve the situation. So my question would be to the USERF, when we have this kind of initiative, how this could help really to be promoted in these countries and to positively impact the situation of religious freedom. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mohammed. It's good to hear your voice. And I think, you know, some of the work you're doing is so important. And frankly, you know, we're always open to, you know, interacting, collaborating with various civil society, you know, NGO initiatives that are working on relevant and similar areas. I mean, I think what you're talking about is such an important element where you have religious leaders looking through scholars who are trying to look at, you know, the standards within that tradition to, you know, justify protecting and promoting freedom of religion or belief in that, in, you know, the Muslim world context and so on. You know, these are very important initiatives, and I think we're, you know, always supportive when we hear these kinds of things. And, you know, we obviously meet with a number of the various different religious communities and interfaith, you know, efforts that, you know, to talk about some of the initiatives underway. And sometimes, you know, we don't necessarily in our reporting get into such detail about a specific program. If we'll, you know, say, you know, we support or we think that in this particular country there should be, you know, U.S. government support, because keep in mind our recommendations are going directly to the U.S. government. That's by statute. We're offering recommendations to the U.S. So what can the U.S. do, whether it's policy or in the programmatic side? So if it would be, if we think it's something that the U.S. should support, you know, financially, then we could make that recommendation. And to be honest, there's different views on that, especially in various contexts, whether U.S. money is a positive or negative thing in various contexts. However, you know, we certainly are willing to talk to anyone about various activities and programming. And it sounds like, I think we're overdue anyway, Mohammed, for a meeting or some of the work you're doing in Morocco. But thank you for your question.
Thank you.
I think we have time for one last question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Paul DeVries with New York Divinity School.
Thank you very much. And again, what an awesome resource and great insights. Earlier, the question came up in a situation where the church leaders in Niger had officially forgiven those that had attacked their churches. And I thought of the comparison with the Charleston situation where these wonderful church members were, you know, forgiving the this racist terrorist. Does this happen in other cases? I guess my question is, does this happen in other cases that you're aware of? And does it have any effect on the tone or the, you know, what happened, the consequences, the actual future of religious liberty in those situations where the aggrieved parties forgive?
Let me give you one example, because I think that's an important question in the context that I know most intimately that's relevant here is Egypt, for example. And Egypt's a country where there has been a lot of sectarian targeting, and I, as I would posit, you know, in Upper Egypt, the southern part of Egypt, and one of the of Coptic Christians in particular. And one of the things that happens regularly are these reconciliation sessions. You know, in a cultural context, someone is aggrieved, even killed, not just you know, injured or property damaged. And then the local religious leaders, both Muslim and Christian, come together and they want to basically, you know, get a deal without going through the you know, the legal channels, and to forgive and reconcile and so on. And you know, a position we've taken, you know, over the years is that, you know, reconciliation, forgiveness, I think there's definitely a place for that. But when there is, when there are people being targeted and property being damaged, people being killed,
We strongly support the rule of law and justice to prevail there. And there's still, that doesn't mean there can't be reconciliation and forgiveness. But in that context, when you don't have an equal balance, let's say, between the various communities, or you have a religious leader that's, you know, pushing something on another religious leader or community, it doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be justice. So I think we would err on the side of let's let the rule of law take its course in countries, of course, that have that capacity. But it doesn't mean that you know, can't be part of the equation. But if it's in some cases, if it's the only part of the equation, there may be some aggrieved parties that never feel like justice was done, even though there may have been some forgiveness. So I think it's not a black and white answer, but that's just one context where I feel that kind of thing is not necessarily going to arrive at the outcome that's going to be beneficial for all parties involved.
Elizabeth, do you have a perspective on that?
Well, the example that came to mind was to my mind was the example Dwight gave of the reconciliation in Egypt. Other than that, I'm not aware of particular situations we've seen that arise, but I would just second what Dwight said. I mean, you know, I think we won't say the same about the Charleston thing. While there were families that said that they forgave, I don't think anybody was calling on the shooter not to be prosecuted.
Yeah.
You know, they're sort of both things can happen, but it is really important. You know, governments need to provide rule of law and justice when there are these grave human rights violations, which the killings in Charleston, you know, certainly were as well. So, you know, I don't think that the forgiveness can substitute for the need for justice in these sort of cases.
Okay, and this is Tiffany. I just wanted to add the situation in Nigeria where there is a lot of effort on reconciliation and dialogue when there is sectarian violence, when there is Muslim-Christian violence, at the expense of rule of law, and that's the solution that is being pursued. But all that has led to is instead of forgiveness and a full reconciliation effort to move forward, all that has led to are angry communities which just take law into their own hand any time another incident has arisen. So it's just led to cyclical episodes of violence in Nigeria.
Well, I'm afraid we are out of time, but I wanted to thank Dwight Bashir and Elizabeth Cassidy and Tiffany for your comments and analysis. We really appreciate it, and for the work that you're doing at USERF, producing this report and trying to bring attention to the religious freedom around the globe. Just as a reminder to everybody, you can follow them on Twitter, at USERF, and they all have individual handles as well. So you can search for them on Twitter and find them. So Dwight and Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Thanks,
Arena. We appreciate it. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, ladies.
I hope you will follow us at our Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative on Twitter at CFR_religion for announcements about upcoming events and information about the latest CFR resources. We hope your summer's off to a great start. We look forward to your participation in future discussions.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.